Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections. Join them in the Ivy League of cheese education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Welcome to Cut and Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren. And on today's episode, we take a look back at a throwback episode, Greg Blaze, dating back to 2014, almost a decade ago. In this episode, Greg chatted with Mike Lee of Twig Farm, Vermont, and Judy Schott of Caprio Goat Cheese, Indiana, to learn the differences between the two goat cheese makers. Each farm milks the Alpine breed of goat, but has very different cheese-making styles. We thought this would be a very fun listen, especially for the spring, and we hope you dig it as much as we did. Cheers, and enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze, and we're here with the second installment of our Old School, New School series. Last week, we talked to a couple of producers of cow's milk cheeses in the U.S., and today we'll be talking to two goat cheese makers and getting their input about the state of artisanal American cheese making, both past and present. Representing one of the pioneers of artisanal farmstead goat cheese making is Judy Schott of Capriole Goat Cheese, who's on the line from Greenville, Indiana. How are you today, Judy?
Great, and how are you?
I'm fantastic. We also have Michael Lee on the line. He is the owner and head cheesemaker at Twig Farm in West Cornwall, Vermont, and he will be representing the burgeoning generation of youthful goat cheese makers. Thanks for chatting with us today, Michael, and how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks.
It's good to have you. So here's a question I have for both of you to start off, and it's simple. It's why goats? And Judy, I'm going to ask you to field that one first. Why did you start making goat cheese?
You're making me laugh. I've asked myself that question, why goats, many times, and I never really came up with a wonderful answer except that I like them. And I liked the cheese because the disadvantages are many. I think you have to really love the animal, you have to love the milk they produce, and you have to love the cheeses that you make from that milk in order to do it, because it's not easy. So I fell into it, 35 years ago as a 4-H project for my children, and pretty soon goats multiply very quickly, to have twins and triplets. And so I'm swimming in milk, and I've got, you know, city kids, because we've moved to the country from the city, who don't want to drink the milk no matter how you disguise it.
And, sure.
And I discovered, French cheeses, and then cheeses from Letty Kilmoyer at Westfield Farm. And
yeah.
I fell in love, and I thought, well, this is why there's goat milk.
So you met Letty. You went to the Westfield Farms to purchase cheese, or you met her at a? How did you come to meet Miss Kilmoyer?
Well, first I met Ricky Carroll, the mother of us all, who wrote her little Cheese Making Made Easy book, which we all learned to make cheese from in our kitchens, and
myself included.
She had introduced me to Letty and several others, and so I wanted to taste these cheeses, which were, of course, so much better than mine because I knew nothing. And that was how it all began, and Letty let me come and spend some time with her and make cheese. And so I decided I could do this, and
Interestingly enough, I know the Kilmores myself. I think I visited that farm because it's very, very close to where I grew up when I was about 10 years old. And I'm pretty sure I served them ice cream at the store that I worked at, which was the first job I've ever worked. But that was a long, long time ago. So I guess I'm old school, too. Or
I'm so glad someone is.
So, Michael, I wanted to ask you the same question. Why goats? Why were you drawn to making goat's milk cheese?
I think a little bit of echoing of what Judy just said. It's I like them. I think I wouldn't be still doing it 10 years later if I didn't like them.
Absolutely.
But the reason why, I think, kind of is framed by a decision that I wanted to farm, and I wanted to farm in a particular place in Vermont where it seemed to me there were a lot of farms around that were milking cows and doing it pretty well. And in some ways, they had spoken for most of the best agricultural land. And the land that I had was very ledgy and not exactly suitable for cows. It could have worked with sheep, but I'd had experience working with sheep, and I think I'd had enough experience working with
sheep. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and so I said, well, let's check out goats, and I've enjoyed goats. I like the scale that they are. Working with them, relate to them very much as a person to an animal. I don't know. I enjoy that, and I love the cheese that you can make with their milk.
But both of you guys said the same thing. So why, if I can follow up, why do you like goats so much? What in goats do you see, I guess, in yourselves? Judy.
They're interesting personalities, aren't they?
Well, they are in my experience meeting them, but I want to ask you, Judy, and why are you guys like goats? I don't know.
Well, I think, if you let them, they would sit in your lap, for
really?
One thing. They'd, eat at the dining room table with you or stand on top of it. And I do believe that for people who don't come from a firm farm background, where you probably wouldn't do anything that silly, they are just charming. And the personalities are so individual, and they're your friends. They're easy to bond with, unlike sheep. I'm sure you'd probably echo that too, correct?
Michael, is that true?
Definitely. Easy to bond with. They're the most personable of livestock that I've ever had the pleasure to work with, and that's a good, and sometimes it's a complicating factor, because it's you are still a farmer, and you still have to make decisions about them based on more than just your feelings.
Absolutely. Well, there's that. I mean, and obviously, you mentioned that you enjoyed the scale. Is that something that you considered, the amount of milk and the amount of animals that you'd have to handle?
Well, I was thinking more of the scale of a goat being, a mature our mature milking goats are about 130 pounds.
Uh-huh.
It's a size I can relate to. I mean, I'm,
sure.
I'm larger than that, but my wife's not. So,
sure.
It's just. That, I guess, and the fact that you have to be gentle in a way with them, because they you could overwhelm them in a way that you couldn't with a cow, for instance.
You could scare
body,
them.
So I think that it provokes a different response in me, I guess.
Is that the same for you, Judy?
Yeah, I think they have very long memories, and if they're not treated well, they remember. We had people here off and on who we let go for that reason, because the personalities did not mesh.
Didn't mesh with the animals.
With the animals at all. They were, they did try to treat them, I suppose, if they'd worked on dairy farms and they'd worked with cows, which were a little harder to move and handle. Sometimes they, goats just don't respond to that. And they do respond most of them do respond to gentleness, but I think all of us who have had them would find that we select animals on that basis too. You know, we tend to have animals in our herds. We keep those offspring whose mothers, you know, work well in that kind of an environment. They are hard. I had a friend one time who had said who had had goats forever, and she said in some ways goats are their worst enemies because it's very hard to make decisions on who stays and who goes,
right?
Because you love them all, well, and that's difficult.
Well, also, wanted to go to the nuts and bolts of what you do. Are both of you are breed specific? I know, Michael, you have Alpine goats, and you have a couple of Saanens and a Nubian. Is that it?
Well,
is that...
I used to. They're pretty much. I've just got Alpines at this point. There's one Saanen cross left, and you know, she's about 8 years old. She's probably not going to be with us that much longer. But the rest are Alpines.
And are those? Did you choose those goats, or do they give you a particular? They work with the terrain well, and they help you make the kind of cheese you like to make.
You know, I'd like to say that those sound like great reasons. But the first and foremost reason was probably aesthetics.
Really?
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. I was looking, I said, I want brown goats. And
I was obsessed with
what I could find.
Well, Judy, you have the same type of, you have the same mix, right? You have the...
Yes. Yeah, we started with an Alpine herd, and, you know, the children showed them, and I fell in love with them. And then, of course, I'm the same. We call those brown ones chamoisé.
Okay.
And they're the most French, don't you think, of all the goats?
Yeah.
You know, I love those brown goats with the black dorsal stripes. But I think beyond that, I found them to be the hardiest of the breeds. They're a little more aggressive than some of the other breeds. And they tend to be, if you have 10, 11-year-old animals in your herd,
uh-huh.
they're usually going to be Alpine.
Right. They're the toughest. They can tough it out
long.
They're
tough, yes.
Well, that's interesting because I find that as a purchaser of your cheese a long time, you make cheeses that remind me a lot of some French cheeses that I bought. And so your goats are French, and your cheeses are, to me, obviously, as well.
Gee, we hope so.
But they're also very distinctly yours. But I was wondering if, you know, if when you began, because I know you work in a different spot than Michael is. You drop down into 30 minutes from Louisville, Kentucky, and to a place that mm-hmm. I'm not sure maybe had those type mm-hmm. of cheeses around before.
Right.
And you've stuck with the same type of cheese. You know, your recipes are known, and your cheeses are known. I was wondering if that was what led you to make that decision.
Well, you know, the terrain thing's an interesting question. We live in an area called Kentuckiana, which really means nowhere.
Okay.
We're not really Kentucky. We kind of fell off the end of the state in Indiana. But it's very similar kind of terrain. It's limestone. It's rocky. It's hill country in the hills above the river. And except for the weather, which is, you know, tends to be not quite as cold as in the wintertime, it's very similar, and it's kind of bourbon country. You know, it's that limestone thing. Water's important here, but I think that those were the cheeses that I'm passionate about. Those were the cheeses. Those ripened goats were the ones that I fell in love
with. Those are the ones that you like.
I love them. I don't make anything. Well, I do make a few things I'm not crazy about. But I love those. I call them the girls.
The girls.
Because I think they're lady cheeses.
Oh.
And they're delicate, and they just rock my world.
Well, nice. Getting your world rocked is great. Michael, you make a very different type of cheese than Judy does. And what inspired you to make the kinds of cheese that you make in Vermont?
There were a couple of things, I guess, that you could say inspired or pointed me in that direction. One, I had a desire, and it's not an ideological desire. It was just a desire to make raw milk cheeses, and it seemed not very feasible to make a lactic mold-ripened cheese out of raw milk and sell it commercially. So I can understand
that.
And so I just kind of started. I was working at a cheese shop, and I kind of just explored all of the possibilities, and I kind of really enjoyed some of the goat's milk and mixed milk and cheeses from both Piedmont and Savoie. And
yes, I. Sorry.
And that's where the inspiration came from. And I said, I think I can make cheeses like that with goat's milk. That's what I set out to do.
That was when you were at Formaggio? And you were eating Percier and things like that.
Percier de Tine. And then just all the sort of little obscure tomas from Piedmont as well. It's just those things. I looked into how you would make Percier de Tine, and I said, geez. I don't think I could do that because I'd have to make cheese every day. And
yes, you would.
Be me.
Yes, you would.
So I said, well, I'll see if there's some other cheeses. And so I just kind of dug around, and then when I got access to milk, I just kind of played with it.
Now, Judy, you guys switched from raw to pasteurized,
right?
And then why exactly did you do that? What made you switch?
I was just as passionate about the raw milk cheeses,
of course,
at that point too, but I wasn't doing the style of aged cheeses that you're doing at Twig. One of the huge issues with goat milk, and I don't want to belabor this point, is that it takes 6 or 7 times the amount of animals to get the same amount of milk you're getting out of a cow.
Sure.
Which is, explains the expense of those cheeses, but it also explains the expense of the production of those cheeses as well. And so we wanted a higher moisture cheese, and those are a little more finicky in terms of safety issues. So for 10 and 12 years, we did make them from raw milk, and then I think it was a number of things. I became more and more concerned about the safety factors, and we did more and more testing, and it got to the point where we were testing for, every batch, for everything, all the time.
That's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, and it was lab work, so that became... Mm-hmm. That contributed to the expense of the cheese. So,
Michael, do you have that same thing that goes on? Do you have to because you make only raw milk cheese? Do you find that you have to test all the time?
We test frequently. We don't test every batch for everything, but we do have a regular testing program, and it definitely adds to the expense of the cheese. A battery of tests on any one batch of milk is going to be at least $30.
And sure.
If the size of the batch is about 30 pieces of cheese, well, that's another $1 for each piece of cheese.
Judy, what? When exactly did you decide to switch from raw to pasteurized?
We did this about 2 years ago, and that was also at the time when there was a lot of scrutiny on these cheeses, and we felt. I think that one of the biggest factors, Michael, is that your cheeses are hard cheeses.
Sure.
Yeah.
Ours have a pretty high moisture content. What sort of yields, for instance, what percentage milk to cheese do you get?
What kind of yield am I getting? Right now they're on pasture, and it is it's awful. Green cheese, I think we're lucky if we get 11%.
Yeah.
That's low.
And so... Our percentage would be a little bit higher on ours. And, ours kind of stay softer and get a little runny. They're a hybrid. They don't really fit in any real category.
Yeah, I mean, that yield for ours is, we'll lose another 25 to 28% in the aging process on our cheeses.
Right. So that's big, and I think when you're dealing with a milk that is expensive to produce, at the time we sort of started doing that to absorb the spring milk supply beyond the fresh cheeses, when the flush came in, that was when we were making
a lot of
our
aged
cheeses. Right.
Absolutely. Those are extremely extremely interesting points. I think it's it's interesting to me for me to note that. I wonder, Michael, if you'll ever get to a point where you feel you need to pasteurize. I mean, I find that whole thing to be quite interesting.
I don't think, you know, if I continue making the cheeses that I'm making, I would feel compelled to pasteurize based on our scale and the amount of testing I do and what I find in our milk now. I think it would probably be a regulatory directive that would force me to pasteurize, and then I would probably rethink like the whole operation because it would change the possibilities for the kind of cheese I would make if I were pasteurizing.
Absolutely. I think that's really a valid point. And I think moisture content is a huge... Don't you think it's a huge issue as far as safety is concerned?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, there are raw milk cheeses with moisture contents that, you know, that, yeah, they get them to 60 days, but I get a little sketched out about them.
Yeah, of course.
I prefer some of these cheeses were sold younger. You know, it's just what happens with that moisture content over an extended period of time at cool temperatures is, it's not anybody's guess. They've seen.
Well,
it's not necessarily a good thing.
Well, guys, we're going to have to take a short break, but I think it's great that you guys are so engaged with each other about the cheese making process. So we'll be right back and continue our talk. Thanks so much.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections.
It feels like a gift to be able to give this gift to people because I know that from my own experiences, I know how valuable, consolidated, incredible training resources are.
They offer an in-depth education on all things cheese, as well as an active network for peer support and career development.
You can pop over to the Quad, which is our social networking and engagement app. And so that's a really fun and dynamic aspect of Cheese State University.
Cheese State's three-part course is designed for seasoned pros and entry-level mongers alike and covers all the skills one needs to perform on the cheese counter.
The structure of Cheese State University is all based on the Cheese State University Field Guide. And that is a three-volume resource. It's all digital, online.
At the end of the course, students will be ready to ace the field guide assessment and earn their Cheese State Scholar Certificate.
Another resource is a video series where we tackle sort of like these thornier questions that you can get on the cheese counter, like what is rennet and like why is this cheese so expensive and can pregnant people even eat cheese?
At Cheese State, you're among experts, you're among scholars, you're among cheese lovers, and most importantly, you are a monger. Join them in the Ivy League of Cheese Education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Coming this spring, we're working on something big for opening soon.
Opening a restaurant can sometimes take months or even years.
So I have this one consulting client that's been 3 months away from opening for the past year.
And I had a calendar reminder show up today, and the reminder was that our goal was to open tomorrow.
But this spring, you'll be able to hear it in just a few hours.
On March 30th, he had passed away, and then on March 31st, he had come back to life. And then on April 2nd, he had passed away again. And I was like, okay, my regards to the family. I don't even know how to receive this information.
So tune in as we follow one of Brooklyn's best and brightest young chefs and restaurateurs on their journey from start to open doors.
Alex, you need to put more money in. We're out. We can't pay anybody.
He is the bratwurst. Oh my God, that guy.
It's The Build.
Subscribe to Opening Soon from Heritage Radio Network, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to our old school, new school discussion of artisanal goat cheese makers. We're here with Judy Shad and Michael Lee of Capriole and Twig, respectively. I felt bad interrupting you guys, and I think it's fantastic that you were talking, and I just sort of got lost in listening to what you were saying. And I wanted to tell you that led me directly into my next question for both of you. And that was, and I'll start with you, Judy. a sense of community amongst cheesemakers. I wonder, when you started to do this, what was the community of people that you were around that made the cheese, and how did you find the communication between cheesemakers? You know, was your mentor willing to give up the information you wanted? How did you get started, and what was your community like back then?
Well, I think people have always been very there are no secrets, really. I mean, you know, there's only so many recipes, that basic recipes, and we all give it our own treatment. But so from some points of view, we shared a lot of information. But there were other things that we, you know, there was always a line you didn't cross. But
what line was that?
Well, for instance, when I went to work with Letty, what we made was basic, fresh, the fresh white stuff that everybody thinks of as goat cheese. You know, there's millions of them, but they say, I want the goat cheese. That's what they mean. I think she was more than willing to share, and that was the basis of everything else they did. So that was the critical one. But no, we didn't talk about her blue cheeses. We didn't talk about some of the other things they did. Those were theirs. And there was a lot of respect among cheesemakers for that. I think maybe a bit more respect than now.
Really?
When simply because there's so many more people in the marketplace. So there's bound to be more duplication, bound to be more you know, things that are very similar, but we were very careful not to cross those lines of what was rather proprietary. And yet, when we had problems, there was no community to go to.
Right.
There were no schools, there were no experts.
Right.
We had each other, and that was, and I think that formed that initial sense of community among cheesemakers, that we had far more in common. Then and the real battle was not among each other. the battle was to get those early goat cheeses into the marketplace, have people have some kind of understanding of acceptance.
You were banded together and fighting against not fighting against, or fighting for
fighting for an awareness of those cheeses in the American marketplace, particularly because there was, you know, there were a lot of people initially who wouldn't even taste anything made from goat milk. So yeah,
there still are, unfortunately. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know where these people come from, but they're out there, because I had a retailer deal with them all the time. It's kind of crazy. But Michael, do you find it's shifted now that there are many, many makers and there are a lot of duplicates? How did you start out? Were you by yourself, or you were exploring cheese styles by yourself? Who was your mentor for a cheesemaker?
I didn't learn to make cheese on my own. I had the pleasure of working with Ann and Bob Works, who had Peaked Mountain Farm down in Vermont. And they're now retired, and there's actually a nice couple that went to school right around here, has picked up at Big Picture Farm down there. They've got goats and make caramels and are making cheese now.
I like goat's milk caramels.
Yeah. Ann Worth was very generous. She was, I think I made cheese with her four times, and she said, I think you've got the hang of it. Why don't you just make it next
time? Go do it.
I would never do that.
No?
Anybody that works with me. But it was very generous of her, and I learned I had to learn very quickly. As far as duplication of styles, when we started here, we had already met Hannah Sessions and Greg Bernhardt, who had started Blue Ledge Farm, which is about 7 miles from here. And a funny thing, Hannah's coming over to pick up some boxes this afternoon. But
put her on the line, man. We'll talk to her.
if I see her drive in, I will. I called them and said, hey, my wife and I are going to be moving to the area, and we're going to start a farm and make goat cheese. But we're not going to make
fresh cheese, and we're not going to make mold-ripened cheese, which is what they were concentrating on. And they were, you know, they were a little wary at first, which I can understand, but they were also kind of supportive in a funny way. And that, you know, that... Well,
I find just the cheese-making, cheese-mongering community, that sums it up for me, like... cautiously supportive. Sometimes I feel like we all are of each other. I don't know why that just struck a chord with me. And can I ask you a pointed question? Do you feel that there are sometimes, and I don't think I have an opinion on this one way or another, but do you think that there are many cheesemakers, sometimes too many cheesemakers, or can there never be enough cheesemakers in the news?
No, I think there's never enough cheesemakers.
That's great.
Do you agree, Michael?
I agree. I think the first time I met you was at Slow, Judy, was at Slow Cheese in Bra, and it was like 2003
Yeah.
And that was to me such a revelation, like the density of cheesemakers from Piedmont. I was thinking, how large is Piedmont? How many hundreds of people make cheese here? My God.
As a veteran of Bra, I can attest to that. And then last year it was so big, I actually couldn't get down some streets in there.
Oh my God.
You know, I do remember, Michael, I remember meeting you there. And that was one of the amazing places that for such a big world, it's also such a small one. And you could go around the corner and there were the guys from Neil's Yard, and you said hello just as you were walking down the street, and then you went down a little bit further, and there was an Irish cheesemaker, and then there were the French guys that you'd met, and blah, blah, blah. And so it was, it's still in some ways a very small world, and I think there's a really strong sense of community. I still... when I have a real question, I still call Allison at Vermont Butter and Cheese, or I call Mary at Cypress Grove.
You call your people, you know.
We call our peeps, and they call us.
That's
so
fantastic.
I think not quite so much as we used to. But, you know, when we began, I don't know how Michael feels about it, but I always felt like it was kind of just cooking, you know.
It was
you did in your kitchen. I mean, it's still here, very much hands-on, touchy-feely, smell it, taste it, look at it, touch it.
I had a fella come in this morning. He came and he shadowed me from about 5:15 until about 10:30. And so I was reminded, because he was taking pictures the whole time for this Instagram thing for Smithsonian.
Instagram thing, I like that.
The Instagram, yeah,
I had to ask him how it works.
Oh, man.
How's that for new school?
That's
right?
Not very new school of you, man. I don't know.
but it reminded me of just, you know, he's like, so how do you, you know, he's just asking questions. Like, well, and he mentioned the idiosyncratic way I seem to be going about doing things. And I was like, well, I do all of these things just so I can get it the same.
Yeah, of course.
And, that's, you know, it's just the way, you know, it's like, it is kind of like cooking. You're trying to come up with this thing, and you've got to respond to what's happening in front of you. And I don't know.
You can't... your egg whites are going to behave differently in your meringue if it's humid outside or if it's not humid. I mean, the same things apply in so many ways to the cheese. And I think one of the huge things with goat milk was because those weren't traditional cheeses in the U.S., and they were in Europe, we used to talk about the fact that in France, for instance, they knew exactly when the milk was going to change, and they knew what to do to adjust their cheese making to the differences in the milk. And we had to learn that, you know, over a period of time. We threw so much cheese away.
Well, in a certain way, I guess all of us here in America are a little new school, even the old school amongst us.
Exactly. But it just didn't take us 600 years to
figure that out. Well, we're Americans. We try to get things done pretty quick. Look, I got one more question for you guys, because we're going to have to go in a second. And I wish I had like a lot more, you know, I wish I had like a, I've really enjoyed talking to you guys. And now my question is, What is the future for both of you and your operations? I asked this to Franklin Peluso and to Jos Volto. Is there a difference between the old school and the new school as far as family goes? Judy, what's going to happen when you, God forbid, you don't make the cheese over there anymore? Who's going to do it for you?
Oh, good God. You know, Letty asked me this 15, 20 years ago. Okay, you got yourself into this. Now how are you going to get out? And I still really don't have an answer. But what I do have here are a core of wonderful, all guys, about four of them that I work with. And increasingly, it's becoming their thing. They're passionate about it. They think about the cheese first. They know that I'm a perfectionist, and they hopefully are too, and you have to be with these very fragile cheeses. They love it. So I'm hoping that, you know, they become the new face. I'll go on until I have to crawl over there. But
Franklin said the same thing to me. It was interesting.
Did he?
Yeah, he did. And Jos... Jos said something different to me, but Franklin said almost the same thing as you. His son was set up to take over. But it sounds like you have a surrogate family of dudes. You said that are
dudes. I love the dudes.
Love the dudes. and Michael, what about you? What's the long view for the Twig Farm? Is it any different from Judy's?
The long view is, it's very hazy, to be honest.
It's very hazy.
So many trees in the way. I think, you know, I'll keep at this for as long as I enjoy it. And then if there's, you know, if my son wants to, well, he's welcome to, but he hasn't really shown much interest. He's only eight, so it's not likely he would show much interest.
Right.
I just kind of keep going. I'm planting a bunch of apple trees, and those take a long time to mature. And,
yeah, they do.
You know, I'll be here.
Well, I wanted to say, you know, thank you to both of you guys for coming on and being a part of this this little series. You know, I feel like we learned three things today. We learned one, that goat cheese makers really like goats, and we also learned that there can never be enough cheesemakers ever, which I think is a cool thing. And what I personally learned is that even though the old school and the new school are different, they operate by the same principles, and that's fantastic.
And we like each other.
Yeah, I think that's great. So thank you so much, and thanks, guys, for listening to another episode of Cutting the Curd live on the Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be back next week with more.
Okay, I hope you guys liked that episode. Springtime goat cheese fun. If you'd like to learn more, please follow Mike Lee on Instagram at Twig Farm. For more on Judy Shad and Capriole, please follow her and her goats at Capriole Goat Cheese. Plus, you can follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Kara Warren. And please listen and subscribe to Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, please feel free to give us a 5-star rating on the Apple Podcast app. This helps us overall and may even broaden our audience. Also, one more thing. Please check out our cheese friend Carlos Yescas' new venture, Cheese Splunker, where he's leading a cheese tour of England in September, where you can visit world-famous shops, cheesemakers, and enjoy a spectacular time abroad. Please look for more details on Instagram at Cheese Splunker. Splunker is spelled SPELUNKER. Cheers, and eat more cheese. Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.